This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy.
Today, the evolution controversy seems as remote as the Homeric era to intellectuals in the East. Today, intellectuals have bogeys much more frightening than fundamentalism in the schools.
That's a passage from Anti-Intellectualism in American Life by the great historian Richard Hofstadter. And if it sounds dated, well, that's because it is. 1963 was when that book was published. Look around today, and the evolution controversy that appeared to be on its last legs 50 years ago, well, it's as alive as ever.
In fact, in the past year, lawmakers in Florida, Texas, Missouri, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Tennessee, New Mexico, they've all considered legislation that would chip away, in one way or another, at the central place of evolution in public school biology classrooms. And it's not just lawmakers rejecting Darwin. Public opinion polls consistently find that about a half of Americans believe in the Bible's account of creation and not in evolution.
Some of you listeners will no doubt say that the battle over human origins is here to stay, that there is an inherent tension between evolutionary theory and Christian religion. And so it might surprise you to learn that for much of American history, even after Darwin came along, practitioners of science got along just fine with practitioners of religion.
So for the rest of the hour on today's Backstory, we're going to look at the way science and religion have interacted across all three of our centuries. And since the topic of evolution, especially when it comes to humans, is what dramatizes the apparent conflict between science and religion the most, we're going to focus on that today. How have our understandings about human origins evolved, so to speak, over time?
Our story begins in the 18th century, right here in Backstory's hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. As you probably know, Charlottesville was also home to Thomas Jefferson. I recently had the chance to visit Jefferson's home, Monticello, with our 18th century guy, Peter Onuf. So, Peter, it's really nice of you to take me back to the 18th century.
Yeah, well.
Peter and I were at Monticello to look at Jefferson's collection of bones. They're one of the first things you see when you enter the front hall, alongside maps, portraits, animal hides, and Native American artifacts. The bones are from animals that by Jefferson's time were extinct. But back then, people hadn't quite wrapped their heads around the whole concept of extinction. One other thing I should mention before we go any farther, Jefferson's religion can best be described as deism. That's the belief in a creator who set the world in motion the way a clockmaker makes a clock, and then, having created it, sits back to watch it tick away. Okay. Let's go to the tape.
And here we are on a level with these very interesting conversation pieces that people would then talk about. They say, Mr. Jefferson, what are we looking at here? They'd be a little shocked at these bones.
These are not any bones, Peter. These are gigantic
bones. They are very
bones.
Big
This
big
is not
bones.
From the family dog.
No. I think we're looking at the giant sloth. We're looking at the mammoth is the big thing here.
So did Jefferson believe that there were current versions of these mammoths wandering around, or did he begin to believe newfangled theory of extinction?
That's too newfangled. Jefferson believed if you had evidence of the existence of a mammoth, for instance, then that mammoth still might be out there roaming the West. And that's one of the incentives for the Lewis and Clark expedition.
Really?
You know, Enlightenment philosophers like Jefferson, natural philosophers, think that our great challenge is to uncover and read the book of nature, that is, of God's creation. And what we don't see now is because of the limitations on our sight that we have to overcome. For instance, we just don't know what's going on in the far western reaches of this continent because no civilized person has ever been there.
So, Peter, looking at these gargantuan bones, would that lead to a conversation about the creation itself, or was that too controversial?
Absolutely. Look around this room. You are looking at God's creation. These are symbols, examples of God's creation everywhere. And what God has created has always been and will always be. It's a perfect creation. In other words, we're not talking about this messy business of the succession of species across time, because if God really were the kind of clockmaker that the deists talk about, then he makes a clock.
And it runs forever.
And it runs forever.
And I suppose that folks who believe that were very threatened at the notion of extinction, because if one part of that clock disappear,
why not another?
What's going to go next?
Yeah, exactly right.
Peter, today the term scientist is almost synonymous with specialist.
Right.
Is it fair to call Jefferson a scientist when he had such a global outlook about his natural science?
That's a great point, Brian. In Jefferson's day, you could not and should not draw distinctions between domains of knowledge. Anthropology, archaeology, botany, they're all part and parcel of the same large project because they're all part of a larger design. For Jefferson, the account of anything is an account of everything. To understand how a particular plant grows or an animal flourishes is to understand something about the larger design of God in nature.
Peter, that's terrific, but I got to run to read the Journal of Sub-Saharan Econometrics.
All right,
so, Ed, people like Jefferson didn't make distinctions between science and religion. How did that change in the 19th century?
Yeah, you have to remember that Thomas Jefferson also went in with scissors and edited the Bible so that it said what he wanted it to say, right?
Exactly right.
And that's kind of a metaphor for the way that people of education handled things in the 18th century. They really didn't feel that you had to take all or nothing. And it's amazing, really, how quickly things changed after Jefferson's death in 1826. In fact, in that very period was really the Second Great Awakening, where people were rediscovering the immediacy of the Bible. And part of that was that you didn't have to hold the Bible at arm's length and see it as a product of an ancient time, but rather it was a living voice. And God might speak to you at any time, telling you that the end was near or that you needed to, you know, create a new religion.
Well, you know, Ed, it wasn't just religion that was evolving, so to speak. It was science as well. And this was the subject of a recent conversation that I had with Ronald Numbers, a historian at the University of Wisconsin, who's written extensively about all of this.
The word scientia, science, had been around since antiquity, but had been a synonym for knowledge. In the early 19th century, students of nature started using it more and more in the restricted sense of knowledge of nature. And one of the requirements for participating in this enterprise was that regardless of one's religious beliefs, if you were participating in science, doing science, you would not invoke the supernatural. Theologians had regarded themselves as part of the scientific discussion, if you will, and they found themselves on the margins at best and didn't particularly like it. However, by and large, during the, say, 30, 40 years before the appearance of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, before the outbreak of the Civil War, there was a fair amount of harmony between science and religion.
Ronald Numbers told me that this harmony remained in place even after Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species hit American shores at the end of 1859. That was due in part to the efforts of Darwin's biggest supporter in the U.S., a Harvard botanist named Asa Gray. Gray argued that not only could humans be exempted from Darwin's law of natural selection, but that the twists and turns that evolution took could be attributed to God.
I think that Asa Gray was really trying to defang Darwinism for Americans and other theists. But what isn't as well known, perhaps, is that Darwin did the same thing. At the end of The Origin of Species, he says that the evidence that he's presented indicates that all plants and all animals descended respectively from four or five originally created kinds. And then in the second edition, Darwin adds, by the Creator.
Ah.
In correspondence a few years later, he expresses regret that he had introduced Pentateuchal language, but he never took it out. It went through six editions before he died, and he left it in there. So he couldn't have been that sorry.
If Darwin was more Christian than a lot of us think, American Christians were at the same time becoming more scientific. By the end of the 19th century, many theologians had come to terms with evolution. And then, in the 1920s, something changed. Laws started popping up in a number of states banning the teaching of human evolution. I asked Ron Numbers what was behind the emergence of an anti-Darwinist movement 6 decades after Darwin.
Well, there are several possibilities, and one is the success of evolution in penetrating the churches and schools of America. And one of the things we see after World War I is just an explosive growth in public secondary school education.
Right.
Where they're going to run across these ideas.
Right.
So the success of evolution, I think, was important. Its linkage with the Germans became fairly common. So in World War I, you had the question, why did the most highly scientific culture on Earth engage in such barbaric actions? And the answer was that they had imbibed of Darwinian evolution, among other things. And then people pointed out the decline in morality among American youth. You know, if you taught young people that they had evolved from animals, then you had every reason to expect them to behave like animals.
Huh.
And in the first half of the 1920s, you had a great example in Leopoldin Loeb's murdering of little Bobby Franks.
That was the case of those two whiz kid law students who killed a teenager, right?
You know, they had learned evolution at the University of Chicago, so life meant nothing to them.
Got it.
So you have that sort of social concern that evolution was undermining the value of human life.
That's Ronald Numbers, historian of science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll hear more from Professor Numbers later in the show. We're talking today about the conflict between science and religion, something that, as we've been hearing, didn't really take shape until well into my century. But by 1925, at least in the little town of Dayton, Tennessee, it was all-out war.
Darwin took us forward to a hilltop, from where we could look back and see the way from which we came. But for this insight and for this knowledge, we must abandon our faith in the pleasant poetry of Genesis.
We must not abandon faith!
This is a clip from Inherit the Wind, the 1960 film inspired by the Scopes trial 35 years earlier. Here, defense lawyer Henry Drummond, based on the real-life Clarence Darrow, is squaring off against Matthew Brady, himself based on the trial's celebrity prosecutor and three-time presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan.
But your client is wrong. He is deluded. He has lost his way.
It's sad that we don't all have your positive knowledge of what is right and wrong, Mr. Brady.
In the real-life version, high school teacher John Scopes was convicted of violating a Tennessee law banning the teaching of human evolution. And he and Darrow never got the chance to appeal on constitutional grounds, so the law remained in place for another 42 years. But what the trial did do was strike a mortal wound to the image of fundamentalism in the United States. And the anti-evolution movement kind of shriveled away. Or, at least, that's what a lot of people thought.
The truth is just the opposite.
This is historian Ronald Numbers in another excerpt from Bryan's conversation with him.
William Jennings Bryan died 4 or 5 days after the trial. He became a martyr to the cause. There were far more anti-evolution bills introduced in state legislatures after the trial than had been before the trial. It wasn't until 1928, roughly, that the organized movement started petering out. All the states that were going to pass anti-evolution laws had done so. There was no sense in reintroducing a bill for the third time. So it just died a more or less natural death. And what happened then was that the fundamentalist who still in the 20s had hoped to capture the mainstream churches and religious colleges, threw in the towel and started building up their own empire. And so they disappear, it seems like, but they're really working hard behind the scenes. They're starting the Bible school movement and Bible Institute of Los Angeles. Moody is thriving. And
that's the Moody Bible Institute?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
And others like that.
Right. You have fundamentalists on radio.
Exactly. They grab a hold of radio right away. So they reappear in the 1960s as though, you know, they're like Lazarus. But actually, they had been working really hard for decades.
That's Ronald Numbers, historian of science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll hear more from him later in the show.
Him will I
part, my precious Lord, and won my heart, and never from him will I part.
I ain't gonna grieve, my Lord anymore,
my Lord anymore.
Ronald Numbers mentioned the Moody Bible Institute as an example of the fundamentalist institutions that thrived in the decades following Scopes. Well, in 1937, Moody became the home base for a California pastor named Irwin Moon. For years, Moon had been traveling the country, drawing huge crowds to lectures that were part religious sermon, part science demonstration. But Moon soon realized he could hit a lot more people with the help of modern technology and started producing short film versions of his shows. They were a big hit and actually did manage to cross over into the mainstream. From 1947 to 1948, at least 2.5 million people saw Moon's films, and by the mid-50s, some 400 public school systems across the country were using them as teaching tools. Backstory producer Catherine Moore sat down to watch some of the films and brought back this report.
Power. Lights. On.
That's 1,000,000 volts of electricity shooting from the fingers of an evangelist preacher. This demonstration of electrical resonance from the film Facts of Faith earned him the nickname Million Volt Man. Dr. Irwin Moon spent his life demonstrating another kind of resonance too, that between faith and science.
For some reason, many people seem to have two compartments in their brain. They keep their science on one side, their religion in the other, with a wall between them. They're afraid to remove the wall, fearing that their faith will be swept away by fact and hard reality.
His film set in Chicago also had two compartments, divided by a wall. But there was a door between them. In a preacherly three-piece suit, he sits in his study, surrounded by leather-bound books, and preaches sermons from science. And sometimes, he puts on a lab coat and opens the door.
We're going to explore the mystery of time in the laboratory. Hello, Pete. How are things going?
Fine, Dr. Moon.
Mr. Margosian is one of our skilled technicians here at Moody Institute of Science.
In 1925, religion and science battled it out at the Scopes trial. But for evangelism to remain relevant in a scientific age, Moon knew they had to make peace. Plus, after World War II, he and all Americans were living in a world that could be destroyed by science.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
According to Moon, we had a choice. Atomic science could be used for good or for evil.
Who will decide which it shall be? Well, one thing is certain. Science alone can't decide it. And now as never before, we see the importance of faith, of righteousness, and of humility before God. Principles upon which this country was founded, and the only principles upon which it can continue to exist.
The U.S. military agreed. In 1947, it launched a mandatory, religiously-oriented education program called Character Guidance. Chaplains used the Moody Institute films to teach morality, spirituality, and citizenship to troops. Public school teachers used the films to teach science. After Sputnik's launch in 1957, Congress passed the National Defense Education Act to close the brain gap with communist Russia. Among other things, it boosted funding for audiovisual equipment for teaching science. It just so happened that Moon was producing some of the most innovative instructional films out there, just as AV equipment began whirring and flickering in classrooms all over America.
Even the microscopic world has its comedians.
These little fellows are just about as funny as they come.
One of the most intriguing discoveries in modern science is the fact that there is nothing in this world that even approaches what might be called truly solid.
Say, what's this? Looks like something out of a nightmare, doesn't it? And it could be if you dream of bats.
Have you ever wondered what goes on in the brain of a homing pigeon? Somewhere within its tiny head is locked a secret no man has ever seen.
This is a wonderful world.
But perhaps the greatest wonder of all is man himself.
Moon's explanations of nature, so full of wonder, simultaneously invoked reason and mystery.
Have you ever wondered about the peculiar shape of the red blood cell? Someone has described it as a cross between a donut and a pancake.
In The Red River of Life, Moon's lab team creates a formula to describe the ideal red blood cell shape. Then they submit it to a room-sized IBM supercomputer to see what shape it spits out.
All that remains is to push the right button, and the answer to our problem appears on the oscilloscope screen.
The image on the screen exactly matches the geometry of a red blood cell. Its perfect engineering demanded an explanation.
And to me, the only adequate explanation is intelligent design. It would seem that if a man wants to believe in God, he has, just within the red blood cells of his body, at least 30 trillion very good reasons for doing so.
For Moon, empirical study of the universe amassed evidence of God. And buried in scripture, he found scientific truth.
The book of Leviticus, chapter 17, verse 11. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And again in the 14th verse, for it is the life of all flesh. The blood of it is for the life thereof. The Bible probably has more to say about the blood and its importance than any other book ever written outside of a textbook on hematology.
When Moon peered through a microscope at a red blood cell, he looked through two lenses. One was the physical lens, revealing a nifty biconcave disc. The other was the invisible but equally powerful lens of faith. The second lens may have had little to do with science, but like science, it had everything to do with truth and certainty in an unsettled world. Reverend Moon's film set had two compartments, but between them was a door.
That's Backstory producer Catherine Moore. We'll post links to a few of Moody's films at backstoryradio.org.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I was really surprised, though, to hear the phrase intelligent design being used way back in the 1940s, because I don't really recall that until more recently.
Yeah, I think that's right, Ed. We associate intelligent design, capital I, capital D, with the late 1980s and 1990s. And I think there's a very specific reason for why it starts in the late 1980s. And that takes us back to the courts. The Supreme Court says, 1987, if I recall, that in fact, creation science was not a science. So it had no place in public school classrooms. The intelligent design people turned around and said, hey, no problem. We're fine with the idea of change over time, the heart of Darwinian evolution. It's just that that change isn't random. That change is the result of God's work. Look at the complex organs like the eye, they said. Those organs could never have evolved randomly. So basically they're saying, you know, if we can't fight them, we're going to join them. We're going to take our religious beliefs and kind of push them through this vessel that we're going to call science, taking us all the way back to your period, Peter, taking us back to that clockmaker who started things off, and then we have the evolution, things set in motion, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, and there's so many issues in American history. When this really gets into the schools is when it really hits the ground. And this maybe is the leading example of how an intellectual debate really becomes concrete in our schools. So we wanted to figure out what this science versus religion debate really looked like in that context. And so we called up a science teacher in my old stomping grounds of East Tennessee.
My name is Joe Wilkie. I am the science teacher at Ray County High School. I've been here for 27 years.
Now, there's a lot of things I don't know about, but I am an expert on East Tennessee geography. And I can tell you that teaching at Ray County High School means that Mr. Wilkie is teaching in none other than Dayton, Tennessee, the site of the infamous Scopes Monkey Trial. We thought it would be interesting to hear from the person who teaches science to the great-grandchildren of the kids in John Scopes' classroom back in 1925. Mr. Wilkie actually runs the Ray County Science Department, so we were a bit surprised to learn that he does not consider evolution to be a valid scientific theory, because a theory is something you can actually test with evidence.
If you're going to use a scientific term, I would call it the evolution hypothesis. And I'm kind of, in my opinion, I'm kind of stretching it there to call it a hypothesis. It's a little bit more like science fiction to me.
Well, let's go over to your understanding of what happened then, okay? You know, if one of your students comes to you and says, Mr. Wilkie, okay, what did happen? What would you say?
I would have to say, no one knows. Because science cannot prove that. Science cannot tell you how you got here, the origins of man or any other thing that you want to name.
So you would emphasize more what we can't know rather than have another explanation, let's say creationism, as we think about, or intelligent design?
Well, I think intelligent design is as viable of an explanation about the way life is as anything that evolution has to offer.
I see.
There is no way that you can prove that there was an intelligence that caused this cell to be here.
Mm-hmm.
But can you look at the cell right now and see the intricate nature of it and start to appreciate how marvelous and complex, I mean, truly complex. I mean, we still don't understand all the complexity of the cell.
So it seems to me that you're not really claiming then the undeniable supremacy of intelligent design over evolutionism. You just say that they're sort of on an equal footing in their inability to prove their observations, and so that they should be basically taught on an equal footing. Is that your position?
Yes, sir. If you're going to teach them, I would say both of them have equal footing.
Does the state of Tennessee agree with that?
The state standards that we have been given by the legislature state that we are to teach about evolution. And that's what the teachers of Ray County High School do. They teach about evolution.
So, you know, the Scopes trial began with, in many ways, testing the power of legislators to determine what was taught and not taught in the schools. Do you feel that we have it about right now in Tennessee, that the scope of what, so to speak, of what you can teach is appropriate, or are the legislature still kind of too involved in the educational process?
As far as science goes, teach where the evidence leads you. I don't understand why the legislature or the courts should dictate what is being taught in science. You know, if a scientist is going to be searching for the truth about something, let it go where the evidence takes him. And, of course, I guess I'm prejudiced there because, you know, I believe that the Bible is truth. And that's because I'm a Christian. And that's why let's go where the evidence believes, because I believe that the evidence will back up what is actually stated in some way in Scripture. That's what I believe.
That's Joseph Wilkie, who's a science teacher at Ray County High School in Dayton, Tennessee.
You know, guys, it occurs to me that the real issue here is not science, it's history. Where do things come from? And that the whole issue of modern science should be framed in historical terms, and that we should think about history as the central problem, is really a tribute to Darwin's influence. Because with Darwin, we had a new cosmology, a new way of thinking about the sequence of things through time. And I think you could say, really, that what they're doing, the intelligent designers, is synthesizing Enlightenment science with Darwinian science.
Yeah.
So you get the best of both.
Peter, I think I'm following, but help me out with Enlightenment science versus Darwinian science.
Well, Brian, you and I think we're enlightened today. Maybe we are, but the Enlightenment has a notion of the cosmos and its history, which suggests that it's a great clock, an elaborate mechanism, and what we need to do is figure that mechanism out. It's an empirical task. We have to understand how the gears mesh. Now, that's a very static idea, and Darwin introduces a dynamic idea. That is, nothing ever is the same because of constant change through history.
And it's interesting, too, that Mr. Wilkie then says, let science go wherever it may and
right.
let the legislature stay out of it, which is exactly the opposite, of course, of what had happened at his own school 85 years earlier, in which the legislature was intrusive, and it was Clarence Darrow and the voices of modernity that said, stay out of this.
That's
now
right.
It's the voices of creationism and intelligent design are saying, let science speak to us directly without the intrusion of the state. So, boy, all these different elements keep combining in different forms.
It's almost like recombinant DNA, Ed. And on that note, it's time for another break. When we get back, we'll return to my discussion with historian Ronald Numbers and look at the creation of creationism.
We want to know what you think about all of this.
Science.
The discussion is underway at BackstoryRadio.org. We'll be back in a minute.